I know how to tell the truth. I know right from wrong.
I'm Christopher Martinez.
I'm Christina Onnestad, reporting for Pacifica Radio.
Welcome to Africa Now. Today's show features Radical Histories and Liberation in Kenya, Part 1. Africa Now is next. Welcome to Show Mwiza Muntali. The music in the background is Baba Africa by Christine Kamau. To contextualize the current nationwide protests in Kenya, Africa Now goes into its archive to present a conversation with Waringa Wahome that explores radical histories of Kenya and the praxis of liberation. Waringa Wahome is an organizer, political theorist, lawyer, member of Mathari Social Justice Center, the Communist Party of Kenya, as well as the Kenya Organic Intellectuals Network. The show also features Valentine Githai of the Gen Z movement briefly discussing the protest movement in Kenya. Here is Africa Now's executive producer and co-host James Pope with Waringa Wahome.
In Mau Mau and Nationhood, the editors write, new states are often declared in the name of peoples not yet aware of their own collective existence. The heroically unified past and manifest joint destiny have yet to be imagined for them. National imagination follows the state. After a new state's formation, its schools can teach a standard language. Its sergeant majors can shout it to conscripts on parade grounds. Peasants can thus be turned into citizens. Invented common festivals and subsequent long histories of political compromise may together combine, but not always, to create a patriot culture with a past to be proud of. The myths, the origin stories, the narratives of a real and imagined collective identity are pieced together as a product of historical experiences of a people who came to dominate the structures of the newly formed state. Its implementation, its functions are guided by a philosophical structure developed and redeveloped that demands the consent of the masses to give legitimacy to the rights of the ruling class. Rights from which all conceptualizations of law and politics henceforth narrowly applied and often stripped from the lower classes. Accordingly, the editors of Mau Mau and Nationhood go on to write, no nation is born without having to face up to questions about who is included, whom is excluded, about how equal the rights of citizenship can be in practice, what degree of privileged differentiation is tolerable between regions, languages, and personal status, what, in any conflict of rights, it means to be subject to more than one rule of law, local and customary, national and statutory. This national history, which is in fact a history of imperialism, hides, distorts, and marginalizes the histories from below. The radical histories of a people who fought against the imposition of these myths, as these myths are a result of ideological propensities to dominate the created other. Mapping radical histories, paying attention to the demands that whatever conceptualization of rights that are agreed upon must be applicable to the humanity of the marginalized, where a peculiar form of philosophy of life was imposed upon those who were already there as well as those forced to be there. The narratives, the discourses of freedom, liberty, justice, rule of law must be stretched beyond their limits through consistent resistance to their disproportionate limited application and negative impact. The way we engage in this process of mapping must include a liberation of the discourses that are created to expose the false legitimacy of the state in all of its contradictions. Writing in the preface of the re-release of Mau Mau from Within, an analysis of Kenyan's peasant revolt, under a new title, The Mau Mau Within, Story of the Land and Freedom Army, Ngugi wa Thiong'o highlights the importance of the notion from within. According to Professor Ngugiwate Thiong'o, the from within is key to understanding the possibilities of radical histories, as the story of the struggle of the Land and Freedom Army has far too long been written by those without. For Ngugiwate Thiong'o, as has been the consistent purpose of his life's work, there are two categories of those who write without. The first category consists of authors of colonial narratives, i.e. Ian Henderson, The Hunt for Dedan Kamathi, or Carruthers, The Psychology of Mau Mau, who saw the movement and the soldiers for freedom as nothing more than a mumbo-jumbo-ish cult. The selected vocabulary was intended to reinforce this narrative. The second category is that of many African scholars, and even those writing from abroad, who were able to treat Dedan Kamathi and his soldiers and the masses that supported them as constituting a serious anti-colonial struggle. But both categories of scholars, even when in profound disagreement, tend to use the vocabulary of the colonial in talking about the war. Professor Mushiri Mugu, writing in the same new edition, suggests that this expanded edition is very significant, as it is imperative that we spend time examining the larger context against which to view the movement, particularly as Kenya suffers from either a self-imposed amnesia or what she calls systematically imposed socialized amnesia, especially when it comes to remembering the histories of colonial oppression and the resultant chirotic and herotic efforts by the masses not just to resist, but to overthrow the enemy. This suppression and repression of memory over a people's struggle is a lethal weapon in imperialist psychological warfare. The coercion of forcing oppressed people to forget, replacing the histories from below, results in the erasure of memory. And in this condition, the oppressed become zombies under the manipulation of those who impose the state. Nevertheless, fortunately too, in psychological warfare, there is always a dialectically positioned group of intellectuals whom Walter Rodney described as guerrilla intellectuals who are essential for the full liberation of a colonized people. This group of intellectuals, due to their function, must also be capable of class suicide. In Kenya today, there is the very real materialization of this principle, captured in a network of organizers, activists, thinkers who are committed to radically restructuring the fundamental relationship of the masses to the structures of the state, to each other, to the environment, their relationship to the world, the African world. Facilitated by a complementary network of social justice centers, this group of organic intellectuals are mapping the radical histories of Kenya using history as a weapon, fueling the formation of a critical Africana consciousness. The logical conclusion points to building a sustained resistance to the intentional imposition of historical amnesia, a weapon of the imperial. Today, we explore radical histories of Kenya and the praxis of liberation with Waringa Wahome. Waringa Wahome is an organizer, political theorist, lawyer, member of Mathari Social Justice Center, the Communist Party of Kenya, as well as the Kenyan Organic Intellectuals Network. She is also principal organizer of a network that legally supports activists and other organizers who are targets of repressive elements of the state. Our show is produced today in solidarity with the Native, Indigenous, African, and Afro-descendant communities of Standing Rock, Venezuela, Corporation Jackson in Jackson, Mississippi, Brazil, the Avalon Village in Detroit, Colombia, Kenya, Palestine, South Africa, Ghana, Haiti, and other places who are fighting for the protection of our land for the benefit of all peoples. Enjoy the program. Thank you for joining us today, Waringa. How are you?
I am doing very well, and thank you for having me.
No problem. I'm really excited about having this conversation with you, because this is an initial conversation that I am intentionally trying to develop more substantive continuity in the way that we think about the African world, by making sure that we connect with folk on the continent, connect with folk in the communities who are organizing to restructure their particular conditions by using any means necessary, to quote Malcolm, but also using the ways of knowing that were produced in those particular places. And the place that I'm talking about and talking to you about right now, of course, is in and around Nairobi in Kenya. Again, thank you for joining us. And let's just dig right in. Let's just go right into,
you know, a conversation. Tell us a little bit about yourself. Tell us a little bit about who you are and also how you begin your path into organizing in and around the communities that you organize.
Okay, thank you very much. Like I said, or like you said, my name is Warenga Wahome. I am a member of the Communist Party of Kenya, and I organize with the Mathare Social Justice Center, which is an informal community-based organization, which documents and writes about the struggles of people in informal settlements, and particularly the places that are most deprived of social justice, of the basic needs that are guaranteed in the Constitution of social justice. We say right to food, we say right to water, we say right to healthcare, we say right to housing, the basic needs, and they're the most deprived of such needs. So organizing in that community, it just gives life and gives hope to see a different world. Seeing that we are organizing in the bedrock of imperialism, you know, we're in Kenya, and in Kenya is where so many things have happened historically. You know, we've had the capture of Buthaland in Kenya, we've had the killing of so many progressives by our own neocolonial governments. So, I mean, the hope for a different world is what moves me, and the hope for just a social just world, one that obeys human rights, one that follows rule of law, one that is, we're living in a democratic state where it is not divided in a manner that there are some people that have basic rights and there are others that struggle to even survive. So I think in my work, particularly as a human rights lawyer, social justice advocate, I do these things because I want a different world. So we use the law as a tool to a different world.
So this notion of social justice is a very interesting notion, because one of the things that I try to, you know, kind of disrupt is this idea of qualifiers for justice. Because again, as a human rights lawyer, there is this sense in the context that rights and categorized into different categories based upon a specific individual. How does social justice, as being defined from a structural institutional base, right, as a human rights lawyer, and also how does that either promote or contradict what is happening on the ground in the places that you're organizing? Meaning this, is there a sense of justice that is different than the institutionalized conceptualization of justice from a specific, I would say, Western perspective?
Yes, of course. Of course, there's a different perspective of social justice. But at the same time, particularly organizing in such a capitalist state and a neocolonial state as this one, there are limitations to these laws. There are limitations to the legal procedures that have been set. One that, of course, are not for the poor. So it's very hard for the poor to access social justice. It's very hard for them to access most of these things. And it's a structural problem. It's systemic and it's structural. And those things we understand. So the importance, particularly of human rights lawyers, is to take the law as it is on paper and bring it to our field of organizing. So the laws that have been provided for in the constitutions, the provisions that we have, those particularly, for example, of our constitution, which is a very progressive constitution, for example, Article 43, the one that provides for social justice. You know, taking those particular problems that have been provided for and taking them to the heart of struggle. So we take them back to the place we're organizing. We take the law and take it to the people. And the importance of doing this is because, for example, Mathare has a whole problem of land. And the situation of Mathare is a question of land. And it's a question of state suppression. It's a question of annihilation of young people based on poverty. It's about criminalization of poverty. It's about criminalization of healthcare, criminalization of everything. Everything that can be termed as a right or even a social justice desired right for human beings. And such things that we have to organize around. We have to organize around land. We have to use law as a tool to organize around land, to protect public land, to protect community land. And that is the only easiest way that we can take the law to the heart of the struggle, taking the law from the documents, taking the law from theory, and at least organizing it and using it to organize for our practice.
So what are some of the ways that you have been able to use that? It would be interesting to look at some of the actual practical material aspects of organizing, and particularly land. And your point about land is essential. And of course, we know land is essential in the history of radical and revolutionary organizing in Kenya as well. Could you talk about the use of land as a fundamental component in liberation, in justice, in understanding the history of radical organizing in Kenya?
Yes, of course. Mathare has always been a hub for anti-colonial organizing since we can trace all this historic. And the struggle of Mathare can be traced all the way back to when Mau Mau, which were the freedom fighters of our country, were organizing in Mathare. It's a working class base that houses working class and the most deprived in society, which forces them to organize against their conditions. So we have, during the colonial times, when Mau Mau was organizing against colonialism, they used Mathare as a hub. And now the development of the struggle has gotten to a point where now we're organizing for social justice. Now we're organizing towards, it's quite similar, the struggles are quite similar, because Mau Mau's actual name was Kenya Land and Freedom Army. So what they were fighting for was land. And the question was land, because they had been chased away from their lands, because most of the people and the occupants of Mathare are people who came from other lands. Reading the history of Kenya and during colonial times, the first thing that the white settlers did, as a form of suppression at least, was acquire the best of lands, what they called white highlands. So they acquired the white highlands, and then they had to push the natives, who were the residents of Kenya or Kenyans at the time. They had to be pushed out of their land so that the white people can occupy very vast pieces of land. So they are, the resultant of the same is that they go to the other side and they come and live in Mathare, cramped up in Mathare. And they're the ones who are the mortars, the working class of the city. And their struggle was for land. And when they were organizing for land. And at that time, even when FAR, Evelyn Baring, gave the state of emergency sometime around 1882, 1881, sometime around there. What he did is that, what happened is that there were fires all over Mathare to chase those people away, because it's a hub for anti-colonial organizing. And now moving forward to a point where the struggle has developed to a point where today it reflects very similar situations. So it's now it's a struggle for social justice. And it's similarly, land is also another big question, because the way people are cramped up, no, the population of close to like 1.7 kilometers square is housing close to 500,000 people, because Mathare houses almost 500,000 people in such a small space. So people are cramped up completely, and it's just violent conditions all over. And at the same time, we have people who have very large pieces of land that lie idle. They're not developed, they're not agriculturally developed, they're not industrialized, they're not doing anything. So nonetheless, it's still a class struggle. And now that people are organizing for social justice, we are organizing so that we can have our land back. Because when people have land, they have ownership, they have sovereignty. And if sovereignty of the people is to come, the people must own the land. And now as we continue to fight for social justice, as we continue to fight for land, even we're involved in activities such as marches that we've done. We've done marches to protect public land. We've involved ourselves in cases that are fighting for land, land that has been grabbed by some greedy people, land that people want to privatize that belongs to the community. Such land we need to protect, and we need all measures possible so that we can protect that land.
And also with the efforts of folk at the grassroots level who are very concerned with the ecological damage that climate change is producing. So now you have, you know, close to 500,000 people in a particular place for a particular reason, because let's talk about a little bit of the history of the area that you're talking about as well, because you mentioned it. But, you know, why were people put there in the first place? Because this is a colonial system. It's a colonial system that moves, you know, housing people and keeping people in a particular area because they are considered to be a threat. However, they need to exploit their labor. Right. So talk a little bit about that in the context of the social justice centers that develop, because you laid out a little bit of the history that goes back to the Land and Freedom Army, but also, and this being one of the hubs, talk about how this particular place was established. It's a place where you marginalize, but yet you need their labor. There's a constant super exploitation that is happening here. Talk a little bit about that and how the development of the center really is developed out of these movements that have been moving over the course of years. And then the center is that institutional hub, that vanguard for a lot of the movements. Talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah, sure. I mean, if you trace it, as you are saying, to anti-colonial struggles, And if we move forward to the involvement that has had, being Mathare being one place that has anchored anti-colonial, neo-colonial struggle and the poverty of just society. And Mathare itself, or Mathare Social Justice Center, is organized around the struggles. People are just forced by conditions to organize around the struggle for social justice. Because if you go back to the history of when it came to be, Mathare was just was used as a quarry. It was the outskirts of the city. So it was a quarry where it provided the workers, number one, for the city of Nairobi. Most of the buildings that are constructed in Nairobi, in Mobaiga, which is an adjacent bourgeois society, and the other place, which is Pangani, which is another middle-class kind of set, has a middle-class kind of setup. And then we have Nairobi. So most of the workers came from either, most of them came from Mathare, and most of the sponsors also came from Mathare. So the level of exploitation among the workers of Mathare, like I said, Mathare is a settlement which has housed the working class and the most deprived of society, which are considered the lumpen proletarians. So the working class in Mathare, who are the ones who are doing the constructions, who are the ones now, it is filled with most of the people who are doing domestic work. And of course, you know, in our society, doesn't regard domestic work as work. So most of domestic work does not even receive labor rights, and they don't even have any recognition in terms of labor rights. So when it comes to terms of payment, they hardly receive any payment that is substantive for the labor that they do. When it comes to questions of, most of them come out and they're paid for, because most of the work that they do is domestic work of cleaning clothes. They wash houses, they wash dishes and whatnot, they cook for the children. That, you know, in such kind of society, in such kind of humiliating conditions, and the payment is so disgustingly low, because most of them will be paid amounts going around 200 shillings, and they need less than, they can hardly survive with such small amounts. So it's just an oppressive and extractive state. Because it's just an extractive, it's a capitalist state. We're living in a capitalist society, which means the workers continue to be exploited. You know, there is no regard for what they do. And Mathare houses such kind of society, and it houses the most depraved of society, I insist.
With most movements, there must be an ideological foundation, a guide in the work that one is doing in order to be clear about the objectives that one is attempting to seek. Could you talk a little bit about the ideological or the theoretical that is being informed both by the work as well? So there are material conditions. You're clearly dealing with some, I don't want us to be, dismissive of the material conditions and just, but I think it's important to talk about how one is developing or how one develops their practice based upon study and struggle. So what are some of those things that you guys are doing to really political education? How are you organizing, people to understand and to become critically conscious of their super exploitation in these particular areas?
One of the anchors and the pillars of Mathare Social Justice Center is documenting of extrajudicial killings, because it's very prevalent where we have policemen. What I say, I saw the post previously by the director of criminal investigation, which is very audaciously stating that what they're doing is annihilating groups. So that is just cleansing of young people and criminalizing their poverty. And at the same time, social justice centers just around the world, they emerge as a reaction, or at least as an organizing base to organize against such oppression. So Mathare, I'm at MSJC, there's documentation of extrajudicial killings, that the people can stop normalizing such. You know, political education is very keen in this case, because class struggle is driving forward. It's prevalent in our society, you know, where so many people are living in such terrible conditions. You know, and political education comes in this point so that it can politicize and conscientize people against this kind of systemic killings, against this kind of, you know, the systemic poverty. And through political education, you know, there is Organic Intellectual, for example, which a militant method of organizing, where within the social justice movement, there's now critical thinkers of the movement who are forming themselves within Organic Intellectuals, who are reading the theory of Marxism, who are reading, understanding how Marxism works, because they get to understand how the state operates. They get to understand the political economy of our country. And along the way, so now it's easy to demystify that kind of information to the masses, because until their consciousness gets to that point where they are, then they cannot normalize these injustices any longer. They cannot normalize poverty any longer. They cannot normalize the lack of basic resources, because people will continue saying that such is life, you know, but that such is not life. It is systemic lack, and the only reason we don't have most of these things is systemic. So now political education is what we do, and organizing marches, organizing campaigns in such kind of manner, because campaigns also are important. For example, previously we did a march on lower food prices, you know, because food prices have gotten to a point that people can hardly afford to eat. People are dying of poverty. So we organize marches in the community or with the community to organize around such matters, because those are things that affect them and those are things that they so easily relate to. So connecting why is it that we don't have food to the systemic connection with the state, because food prices will continue to go up as long as we're in a neoliberal economy. Food prices will continue to go up. Housing will continue. The capitalism crisis will continue to show itself all over. And now demystifying that information to the masses. Now we talk together in conversation through dialogues, through campaigns, through all forms of organizing that we can use that at least within our disposal.
No, and that's very important, because interestingly enough that this pandemic has been able to do was to actually cause a lot of people to slow down, but also to make more connections, you know, make more opportunity for us to be able to have transnational organize, right? How important is internationalism? How important is Black internationalism or a Pan-Africanism? Or how important is it for us to understand in an African context, in an African world context, that the international solidarity, not just in what I would call non-substantive solidarity, but real solidarity with the efforts that folk are engaged in, particularly in the communities that we're bringing to the audience today and that you're organizing with, how important is internationalism to the question of class struggle in Africa? And how does that relate? I guess we can have a conversation. How does that relate to an understanding of class struggle in other parts of the world?
I think I'll start with that one on the pandemic, because if anything, that the pandemic was, I wouldn't say good, but it made clear so many things. It made clear how the state is so disengaged with the lived realities of its people. Because with the curfews that were enforced, with the measures that were enforced, they were so disengaged from what was going on in the lives of the people. Because in most informal societies, in Madare, in Dandora, in Kibera, in all those societies, people are cramped up, number one. So, of course, you cannot tell them to distance or space or whatever. And when you tell them not to work or to work from home or to go to do whatever, the jobs that they do, most of them are casual laborers. So to tell them to work from home is to tell them, I don't know, not to work. And not to work is not to live. So it's condemning them to die, and it's condemning them to more poverty. You know, and if anything, in such a repressive state, the only thing it promotes is a culture of silence and poverty. Because people will continue to be silent and people will continue to be poor. And the importance of going on organizing against that state repression, and the importance of continue to organizing for our land and freedom is through conversations such as this ones. We get to amplify those conversations. We get to have connections of people knowing what is going on in our societies. And I think the internet has made that so simple, because now we're able to relate, for example, with the struggle of Palestine. We're able to relate with the struggle of the Kurdish movement. We're able to relate with so many people that are struggling against, neocolonialism. You know, there's the war, the imperialist war going on with Ukraine and with Russia and the USA. And if we do not amplify this, if South Africa doesn't stand with the struggles of Ukraine and the struggles of Palestine and the struggles of the workers in Kenya, the workers in Russia, the workers in the USA, the workers everywhere, if we're not familiar with each other's struggles, and if we continue, you know, the state has worked very well because the state is so dedicated and it's so well structured within itself, because they have police, they have prisons, they have so many things that they can use against us. They have a whole bodies of armed men, you know, so they have a lot to organize against workers. But again, we insist, like Karl Marx, workers of the world, unite. You have nothing to lose but your chains. You know, so internationalism is important because as long as the whole world is standing with the struggles of one country, and as long as we are all standing with the struggle of workers, this struggle we shall win.
And that's a very important point, because one of the things that I wanted to tease out in your conversation was the exacerbation of these aggressive COVID measures. But also when you're talking about people being able to survive, you also, this had a very, very deep impact on the informal economy, what is considered to be the informal economy, which I don't like that term, because
it's actually unemployment.
Right. Talk more about that.
You know, when you tell people that there is an informal sector, that is just unemployment. Because if you're going to call someone who sells clothes on the streets that they're doing informal business, and when it rains after 20 minutes, they don't have a job in. You know, if you tell someone who sells anything on the streets, and, you know, they're exposed to any environmental condition. You know, if it rains, just a slight change will affect their business. Just a slight change will affect their survival. That is not an informal sector. They're just unemployed people. So the government, you know, capitalism creates them. It just has a way of creating, I don't know what that bandage is. You know, it's some form of bandage, because it's a big wound. But now we're placing bandages and calling them, it's like the way we say middle class. You know, that's just a surviving strata of society. It's not middle class. Most of them are surviving with debt and loans from banks. You know, so if banks or the financial sector was to collapse, even they themselves would not be in survival. So even the informal settlements, informal sector itself, it's just a beautiful word for unemployment, because instead of creating a society where people can, you know, can grow their intellect, can instead of industrializing our, so that people can have employment, instead of, you know, just developing society along with the needs of the people, people have to, you know, they tell themselves, we have to survive, we have to find something to eat. And it's very little money that you get. And most of the people that even do this informal sector work, they're hardly living in any better conditions. Even they themselves are the ones that are most lumpenized. So, you know, it's just a bandage in a very big wound, and it hardly stops the bleeding.
You just listened to a portion of a conversation from our archive with Waringa Wahome that explores radical histories of Kenya and the praxis of liberation. And we present this conversation to contextualize the current nationwide protests in Kenya. Waringa Wahome is an organizer, political theorist, lawyer, member of Mathari Social Justice Center, the Communist Party of Kenya, as well as the Kenyan Organic Intellectuals Network. The music in the background is Uhuru by Osibisa. You're listening to Africa Now on WPFW 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C., your jazz and justice station. Now back to the conversation.
I mean, and that's a very important point, because again, I, like I said, that term of informal economies, you know, it's like you said, it's just a beautiful word for some ugly conditions. Let's talk about, you know, the role of young folk, but also the role of women in organizing, particularly right now. There's a tradition, those who understand, you know, the anti-colonial struggle in East Africa, but in particular Kenya, know that women, had a very important role. What is the role or the vanguard, as to speak, of folk who are organizing in this particular moment?
So the social, we have women in social justice centers, which is a pillar of the social justice movement, which is organizing women. And also, women are the most, because criminalization of men, or young men particularly, is mostly affecting women. Because if young people or young men are killed because of their involvement in gangs, most of them are just recently married. Most of them are just, most of them have kids and families. So now there's organized a group of mothers of victims of extrajudicial killings. So these organizations are very important when it comes to conscientizing, particularly women. And there's a conversation between Lenin and Clara Zetkin on the role of having a separate women's movement or separate women wings within a movement that is now a separate women wing within the party. But in this particular, we have a separate women's wing within the movement. So the purpose of this is to organize women and to organize women within their common struggles, because, you know, women have, you know, they're already living in an oppressive state, going through double exploitation, because, you know, they're exploited as workers and then they have exploitation because of their own gender. Just recently, yesterday, we came from International Women's Day. And the problem with that is that it has become commodified by such a capitalist society, because now it's no longer a conversation for struggle for socialism. Now it's just bourgeois feminism, which has nothing to do with the struggles of workers and the struggle of women. So having a women wing within the social justice movement and having women organizing themselves as victims of extrajudicial killings and understanding that that extrajudicial killings do not occur because their sons are thieves or their sons are criminals or their sons are whatever name that has been, you know, giving, as they have been, they've been given so many bad names, you know, of giving a dog a bad name so that you can kill it. They've been given so many bad things. They're gangsters, they're thieves, they're criminals. And when their kids are killed in those particular circumstances, they understand that they're not killed because of that. They're killed because of criminalization of poverty, you know. And being in a movement that is organizing against state oppression, against extrajudicial killings, against unjust land injustices, against environmental injustices, against injustices on women, organizing around the same and conscientizing women and telling them that, or at least learning together and teaching that it is not, it is a struggle towards socialism, you know, and it is only in socialism that we can have the true liberation of women. You know, it is organizing women within the movement and outside of the movement, organizing our communities and learning together that this is a struggle for social justice, it's a struggle for freedom, you know, and it's a class struggle, it's beyond gender. You know, while we continue to fight for women rights, while we continue to advocate against injustices against women, while we continue to advocate against everything that is going on with women. The other day we had in our society where a woman was stripped almost naked by a group of like 20 men and no one is doing, you know, such kind of things. Of course, we continue to advocate against, we continue to speak out and we continue to spread the agenda, but one that is clear, that the class struggle is the primary contradiction. And when we fight for gender, we are fighting for it so that we understand that it is only under socialism that we can attain truth.
You've just been listening to a portion of a conversation from our archive with Waringa Wahome, that explores radical histories of Kenya and the praxis of liberation. Waringa Wahome is an organizer, political theorist, lawyer, member of Mathare Social Justice Center, the Communist Party of Kenya, as well as the Kenyan Organic Intellectuals Network. We presented this conversation to contextualize the current nationwide protests in Kenya. Since June 18, Kenya has witnessed nationwide protests against the government's proposed tax increase, mismanagement, corruption, and more. The youth-led or Gen Z demonstrations has forced Kenyan President Ruto to abandon the tax proposal and fire majority of his cabinet. According to Kenya National Commission on Human Rights, the police has used excessive force to clamp down on protests that has led to over 50 deaths, over 600 people arbitrarily arrested, and over 50 people missing. In the face of this crackdown, the protests continued yesterday, July 16th. Today, the show features a conversation I had yesterday with Valentine Githai of the Gen Z movement, briefly discussing the protest movement in Kenya. The music in the background is Ulisema by Christine Kamau. Here is the conversation with Valentine Githai. Valentine Githai, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you for taking the time out of your busy schedule to be with us First of all, I just wanted you to give us updates of the protests which have taken place today in Kenya. I don't know if you've heard anything from home of what has occurred today.
Yes, I have heard the protests were, they didn't go that well. The police kept using live ammunition. So far what I've heard is a few journalists have been shot. Luckily, I have not heard of them dying, but there have been a few deaths which have been reported. It's not very clear of how many deaths yet.
And this is the continuation of the protests by the Gen Z movement, which started last month, right?
Yes, June 18th was the first day that the protests started. And today was a continuation of that. But today people were also much angrier because on Friday, there was a dumpster in an area called Kware next to a police station where 40 bodies were found in sacks, mutilated and cut. So that also was one of the things that enraged people today because they're feeling like every time we try to move a step forward, we move 10 steps backwards. And my condolences to those families that have lost their loved ones.
Yes, yes. And if you could also just remind us of the initial demands by the protests when it started in June.
Yeah, so the protests started as peaceful protests. They were about rejecting the finance bill, which the IMF had actually drafted and had coerced the Kenyan government to push. And the Kenyan government did not listen to the people who are the Gen Zs, instead proceeded to killing them and, extrajudicial killings and abductions, where 40 plus Gen Zs were killed and millennials as well, and at least more than 300 abductions. So that was the root. That was the root of it from June 18th. And some of the demands that the Gen Zs made, only one I'd say the president has done, which was fire his whole cabinet. But the president did leave the prime cabinet secretary seat, which is an unconstitutional seat. But everyone has been fired. We have not seen any accountability, any arrests of the killer cops or anything in that manner.
And that's why there's been this continuation as of today, which as we're speaking today is July 16th.
Yes. Some of the things in the finance bill, like the house levy, have not been dropped. In fact, the government said that they have dropped the finance bill. They have withdrawn it. But there are certain criteria that it has to go through parliament and parliament has to officially withdraw it. But the government has sneaked it in some way, because I am getting reports of people saying the prices of sanitary towels has still gone up. So initially they said that they had dropped that clause, but today it doesn't seem like, given the prices, that clause was really dropped. So I guess they sneaked it in through the appropriations bill, or somehow they've managed to sneak some of these things. And this is enraging Kenyans because they feel like they're not being heard. We are not being heard.
Again, that's Valentine Githai. She is with the Kenya Gen Z movement. And she's with us here in Washington, D.C., part of the Kenyan diaspora. And as we talk about the Kenyan diaspora, what are the actions that the Kenyan diaspora has done in solidarity with people back home?
So we're letting the people back home know that we are with them in terms of what we are doing here, which is we are protesting as well. We are creating awareness through platforms like yours, Mwinza. Thank you so much. And we're trying to do a few things here and there in terms of policy making, see if we can get things like congressional hearings, but we also have a very important protest that we are doing, which is will be done at the IMF this Saturday, just to fill in the gap of, you know, Kenyans back home who are not able to come to the physical location here at the IMF and air those views.
And if you could give us more details of the demonstration, which is taking place at the IMF, which you said is on Saturday, July 20, the time and also the actual demands at that demonstration.
Yes. So the time is going to be 12:30 to 3:30 p.m. at the IMF headquarters 2, 1900 Pennsylvania Avenue. That's where we are going to be. What we want to say on that day, we want Julia Koza, because she came on, I think she is the spokesman of the IMF and apologized, but we want the IMF to know that we are holding them responsible for the more than 50 deaths and more than 300 abductions that have taken place. And we also want the IMF to know that they need to stop pushing for this. They need to stop pushing for these structural adjustment programs in countries like ours. We want them to go, because they keep, see, the thing with IMF, they keep pushing these structural adjustment programs, but there are no clauses about things like budgeted corruption, and they don't really care about who it's going to affect and how it's going to affect and how they are going to reach their revenue targets. IMF, we want them to know that Kenya doesn't have a formal sector. We have only like 30% of a formal sector. So 70% is informal, and that's where they want to tax by raising basic commodities like bread, and that is not going to work. So we want the IMF to leave, and we want them to know that we do not accept their apologies right now.
And so one of the things they're demanding is IMF must go. Right?
Yes.
And I also see on the flyer that one of the other demands, which is actually the demands which people in Kenya are articulating, is the fact that they're also saying there's a hashtag for Ruto must go, the president of Kenya.
Yes, we want him gone. We were going to push till 2027 for the next election, but given the trajectory of the events, we want him gone because he's not paying attention, and he has demonstrated to us that our voices don't matter and that he's running our country to the ground. All the killings, if you know, for instance, the Kenyan president, William Ruto, is known as the king of the skies. In 18 months, he has gone for 68 international trips using Kenyan taxpayers' money. And this includes, he uses luxury jets. So he is mismanaging that, and he's not taking accountability, even for those who have confessed to, like, one of the former cabinet secretaries who just got fired went on X and said that we Gen Zs are stupid, that she was not just sitting in her office idly, that she was embezzling money. And we have not seen action being taken. When one of the kids was shot sometime last week, the president denied those allegations. In fact, he didn't even know that the kid was killed. So we continue to see this game that the Kenyan president is playing and all this gaslighting, and we are tired. When he campaigned in Kenya, he said it was going to be a bottom-up approach, a hustler movement. That was the narrative that he used, but he's doing the complete opposite. He's not representing us like we want. And yeah, he should go. In fact, he needs to have gone yesterday. He needs to have resigned, and he needs to be somewhere, actually in jail. That's what I think.
And do you have any other closing thoughts for us?
Yes. So I know this is Kenya, the protests will be by Kenyans, but I know there are many countries, especially developing countries in Africa and the Caribbean, that have been deeply impacted by the IMF policies. I know Jamaica was one. So if you're Jamaica from any of these countries and you're listening, we urge you to come to our protests. We will also have a free speech forum during that time to address the IMF. So I invite you to come in. And yes, Ruto must go.
And where can people get more information on the website for this demonstration?
Kenya, we have an Instagram page. It's called the Kenyan Diaspora Voices. They can get all the information there.
Again, say that again. It's Kenyan Diaspora Voices. All right, thank
on
you
Instagram.
Very
much. Yes.
On Instagram. And then also on the flyer, I see that you also have it's 254 Diaspora. Is that another hashtag?
No, so 254 means Kenya, you know, the.
Yeah, the country code. That's right.
Yes, the country code. Yes.
Yeah. And so again, if you could let us know again for more information, people should go to Kenya Diaspora.
Kenya Diaspora Voices.
Voices. Yeah. Kenya Diaspora Voices Instagram. And that's for the Say No to IMF demonstration, which will be on Saturday, July 20, 12:30 to 3:30 p.m. at the headquarters of the IMF. That's 1900 Pennsylvania Avenue Northwest in Washington, D.C. Thank you, Valentine. Thank you very much for being on the show.
Thank you so much, Mwiza, and thank you for the good work that you're doing.
Oh, thank you very much. Again, that's Valentine Githai. She is with the Kenya Gen Z Movement, who are organizing a demonstration on Saturday, July 20, and that's in solidarity with their country people in Kenya, who have been mounting demonstrations since July. Speaking out against the structural adjustment policies in Kenya by President Ruto. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
To contextualize the current nationwide protests in Kenya, earlier on you heard Africa Now going into its archive to present a conversation with Waringa Wahome that explores radical histories of Kenya and the praxis of liberation. The full conversation with African Isles executive producer and co-host James Pope and Waringa Wahome will be available on African Isles SoundCloud page. That's African Isles online on SoundCloud. The music in the background is Kurima by Chinoiso Marere. That's it for Africa Now for today. I'm your host, Mwiza Muntali. Up next is Headline News, followed by Sha'anana with Zain Al-Amin, which looks at issues in the Middle East and Northern Africa. And after that is the Women's Collective Sofas Parlor, which is followed by Human Rights and Justice with Nkechi Taifa. And that's followed by Black Agenda Radio with Margaret Kimberly, which is followed by Kombit Lakai with Eugenia Charles, which looks at issues in Haiti. Check out Africa Now on Facebook and on Twitter. That's at Africa Now Online. Also, Africa Now is archived on iTunes Podcast and on SoundCloud. Search under Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. That's Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. Thanks to Africa Now's executive producer and co-host James Pope. And thanks to our engineer, Michael Nasella. Thanks to our research fellow volunteers, Chanda Kozer and Funangonda, and our Africa World Now Project collective of Dr. Tasmin Siddiqui, Dr. Keisha Khan Perry, Dr. Josh Myers, and Kurt Utterson. And thanks to the entire team here at WPFW. And particular thanks this week to our colleagues, that's Eugenia Charles of Kombit Lakai, and Netfa Freeman of Voices with Vision. And thank you for joining us as well. Continue to support all the great programs on WPFW. We're going to leave you the closing song entitled Mugana, Mugana by Nairobi Horns Project. Thank you. Have a great day. Have a great week. And stay safe. WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York. I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns with some brief news headlines. Israel kept up its airstrikes on Gaza today, killing dozens of Palestinians, after Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu vowed to ramp up pressure on Hamas. In a speech to the Israeli parliament, Netanyahu said that the country had to apply, quote, pressure, pressure, and more pressure to squeeze further concessions from Hamas in ceasefire negotiations. The Gaza Health Ministry reported today that at least 81 Palestinians had been killed in Gaza over the past 24 hours, bringing the total official death toll in the territory to over 38,700. A recent study published in the Lancet Medical Journal estimates that as many as 186,000 people are dead due to the war, including through indirect deaths caused by food and water shortages and disease. The Israeli military attacks have increased on both residential buildings and on public infrastructure. UN schools used as shelters have been major targets for the past 10 days. Another contingent of 200 Kenyan police officers arrived in Haiti yesterday to lead a UN-backed mission to fight Haitian gangs that have taken control of parts of the country, including most of the capital, Port-au-Prince. The latest contingent arrived nearly a month after the first group of troops landed in Port-au-Prince, of which gangs control at least 80%. The exact responsibilities of the Kenyan forces is still unclear, but AP journalists say some soldiers have been seen on patrol around Haiti's main international airport. The UN-backed force will include troops from several other African and Caribbean countries and will reach 2,500 personnel in total. Kenyan police face accusations of abuse back home, including extrajudicial killings. Kenyan police killed dozens of Kenyan protesters in recent weeks. In domestic news, multiple Democratic senators have called on now-convicted felon Bob Menendez to step down from his position as New Jersey senator or risk facing an expulsion vote. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer said Menendez needed to resign and, quote, do what is right for his constituents, the Senate, and our country. Joining the calls to resign were New Jersey's other Senator Cory Booker and its Governor Phil Murphy, who would appoint any Menendez replacement. A statement from the Senate Ethics Committee said that group is nearing completion of an investigation into Menendez and would, quote, consider the full range of disciplinary actions. The senator, who was running for re-election as an independent in November, was convicted yesterday on all counts he faced, including charges of accepting bribes of cash and gold. Prosecutors say Menendez accepted the bribes to protect business allies from criminal investigations and to illegally help Egypt access millions of dollars in U.S. military aid. Nearly two-thirds of Democratic voters say President Biden should withdraw from the presidential race and allow delegates to nominate a different candidate at the party's August convention. New research from the Associated Press and the NORC polling firm found that about 35% of Democrats want Biden to continue running for president, only slightly higher than the rate among Republicans and independents. The poll was conducted after last month's debate, but mostly before Saturday's assassination attempt on Donald Trump. The AP says the small sample of poll interviews taken after the shooting suggested no change in voter attitudes towards Biden's candidacy. The poll also found that only 18% of U.S. adults think Biden is more capable than Trump of winning in November. Weather in Washington, D.C. right now is 97 degrees and mostly cloudy, with a heat advisory in effect until 8 p.m. In New York City, 89 degrees with fair skies and also a heat advisory in effect until 8 p.m. For WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns. Thanks for listening.